It is true that we may have learned too much too fast as a species. There may be some validity to that. We're not quite ready to handle the power that we now have. But the fact is, it is a fait accompli. It has happened. We can't be Luddites and bury our heads and ignore the reality of science and technology. There is some prejudice that has to be overcome between the two groups for them to be able to cross-fertilize and communicate. In recent years, there have been any number of books that purport to deal with this interface between science and spirituality in general, and often science and Eastern spirituality in specific. Unfortunately, the people that write these books are usually not specialists in the area of Eastern meditative disciplines. So they tend to lump a lot of stuff together and talk in very general terms. In point of fact, for a successful dialogue and interaction to take place, what we really need is individuals who understand both worlds really deeply. Such individuals are very rare at this point in human history. Maybe don't even exist at all. What am I talking about? I'm talking about people that can attain all of the levels of samadhi, have had deep enlightenment experiences, probably meditated for 30, 40, 50 years in a very disciplined way, on one hand, and have PhDs and research experience in the sciences, on the other hand. And a third characteristic are iconoclastic, are willing to see beyond the preconceptions both of traditional meditative practices and standard Western science. What I think is needed, what I would like to see happen, is a generation of individuals like this appearing on this planet. Because ultimately, it has to be inside one person. The disciplines are too deep, they're too subtle for specialists in one to try to communicate with specialists in the other using words. It's very difficult. So I think what we need is a few dozen people that are really enlightened masters. Number one, top-notch scientists. Number two, and willing to, as I say, let go of the preconceptions of both of those disciplines and look at something in a radically different way. And I think if we had several dozen human beings like that on this planet, they could come up with some extraordinary new breakthroughs. My ultimate fantasy on the top of my wish list would be to teach meditation at MIT or Caltech so that I could help foster a generation of people like that. One of the dangers in bringing science and meditation together is that people think that one is trying to validate the meditative perspective by saying, look, the things that we have here, look how similar these are to what science has discovered. And therefore, our spiritual teachings must be true because it's similar to science. Why is that a danger? It implies that science is the true thing, and the insights of meditation become valid if they agree with science. And I'm not sure that such a perspective is at all justified. For one thing, meditation agrees with what science? 19th century science, 18th century science, early 20th century science, late 20th century science. Science itself changes. If you start to say that we're going to somehow validate our spiritual path by showing how it parallels science, then what's going to happen the next decade when science changes? Does that invalidate your path? I think it's extremely naive to try to validate the spiritual path by saying, look, it's so similar to science, so it must be true. When we speak of Eastern internal science and Western external science coming together, we can talk about what the internal science can contribute to the external science. We can talk about what the external science can contribute to the internal science. And we can talk about what the two of them together might come up with and contribute. First, let's talk about what the meditative path can contribute to the scientist. I've already mentioned one thing. In my own past history, the enhancement of concentration power, the elevation of the base level of concentration that comes through the meditative practice, immensely increased my ability to study and learn things, all sorts of things. So a scientist that also practices meditation is going to literally raise their IQ. So one area of impact is in this being able to learn things better because of being able to concentrate better. Secondly, I've mentioned that wisdom mind phenomenon, the mind that can find answers in a way different from the usual linear way. Now, many great scientists have described their most important creativity as taking place in some sort of non-linear mode, which they then later formulate mathematically and design experiments to validate empirically. Einstein said that his theories, his best ones, started in his body, in his bones. He would feel, and then he'd get vague sense of shape and things, and then finally it would percolate up as something that other scientists could understand. The same wisdom mode that we use in the spiritual path to understand the nature of consciousness can be applied to actual scientific problems and can give the scientist a creativity that he or she would not have otherwise. In addition to the concentration power, this mode of functioning of consciousness, which in the Buddhist tradition we call prajna, or wisdom, can be applied to actual scientific problems and lead to enhanced scientific creativity. That's another area where practicing meditation could help a scientist. Finally, when you hear an enlightened person describe the activity of the spiritual source, it might sound a little bit impersonal. It might not sound quite like the version of God that most people want, which is God is a human personality that's going to take care of me the way my human mommy and daddy did. That's an aspect of God, but that's more the Sambhogakaya. That's more the God with form that is in the intermediate realms of consciousness. When you get down to God, that is the source, for someone who has not had experience of God this way, the description of the source may not sound all that inviting, actually. Expanding and contracting effortless waves of nothingness. It doesn't sound very inviting as a concept. It's not quite what we want from God. However, as an actual experience, I absolutely promise you that it will fulfill your every desire as an experience. However cold and off-putting the description may sound, the discoveries of science sometimes sound rather impersonal. They make the universe sound like some sort of activity that is cold and maybe doesn't care about us as individuals. Now, there's something important, extremely important, about the fact that the humanly significant experience of the mystic may sound sort of cold and impersonal to the average person. And the fact that the descriptions of the universe that scientists come up with sound sort of cold and impersonal to the average person. There's an important relationship there. What you have to remember is that for the mystic, this impersonal experience is, as I say, passionately, humanly significant. Because it is by resting in the impersonal that they are able to recharge their batteries and manifest themselves more fully as a human being in a very personal way. The impersonal flows of energy can be interpreted as extremely humanly significant. This is how mystics have been experiencing these impersonal processes for centuries. There is another way to look at the impersonal nature of nature, which is extremely significant for us human beings and empowering for us human beings and fulfilling for us human beings. So it's not so much that the mystic's experience may sound like the impersonal laws of nature, but it's more that the impersonal laws of nature, seen from the mystic's point of view, are not a bummer. They're very significant at a human level. That's another thing that the meditator has to tell to the scientist. There may be a very different interpretation of the principles that you discover, one that you have never thought of, that will help you in your human life. Now let's talk about ways that the scientist can help the meditator. The scientist can help the meditator be clear about vocabulary. In the sciences, it's been a long and hard struggle to clarify terminology. And it's been a successful struggle. That kind of clarity has not yet come into the mystical meditative endeavor, even though there's a copious technical vocabulary. When I compare the clarity of definition of words in mathematics to that even in Buddhist meditation, there's a long way to go as far as the meditation vocabulary goes. It's not nearly as carefully formulated as the language of mathematics is. The meditators can emulate the scientists, clarify their vocabulary a lot more than they have in previous centuries. Science can teach the meditators to question the presuppositions of their traditional systems. That's the problem. This traditional system worked, so there's a tendency to accept it uncritically. But just because it works doesn't mean it's the only way to look at things. And by and large, meditators have not tended to do what we might call a radical critique of the system that allowed them to become enlightened. In science, one does those kinds of radical critiques, and I think that would be a good habit for meditators to get into. Of course, once they've had actual experience, it's meaningless to make a critique until you've actually followed the path. Another area where I think it would behoove meditators to emulate scientists is in the area of communication. The way that scientists worldwide discuss their discoveries and their theories has not been followed by meditators yet. There is some dialoguing going on. There's the Christian-Buddhist dialogue and this kind of thing. But top-notch scientists, people in the top of the field, will get together and they will publicly discuss their ideas. It's all right in the open, and it's very honest, the discussions that go on. And out of that, worldwide understandings take place. Very seldom do deeply enlightened masters get together and really let their hair down and talk about their experiences amongst each other in a public way. It just does not happen very often. And I think it needs to happen. In other words, mysticism needs to become a global shared activity. And that can only take place if the top masters, the really enlightened ones, are willing to communicate in a way that at this time I do not see them willing to communicate in or ready to communicate in. Each one has what they've achieved, which is absolutely phenomenal. They have usually an entire structure around them. There's a lot at stake. It's hard to understand other people, even other enlightened people that may come from other traditions or have used other methodologies. They can recognize in each other by their body language, by the quality of their voice, who is deeply enlightened and who isn't. That is fairly easy to tell, usually. But the top really deeply enlightened people don't talk to each other the way the top scientists talk to each other. And because of that, worldwide mysticism does not evolve generation after generation the way science does. It seems strange to say that people who have seen beyond the ego have ego investment, but I don't know if we really call it ego investment, but they have habits. And those habits prevent communication amongst their peers, at least in my experience. The junior generation, or the ones that are scholars, they can talk. And the people that have meditated for a few years or a few decades, they talk real openly. But I have not seen the great masters talking in what I would call an open way, publicly sharing. So I think that's something they could learn from science, the way scientists behave. Now let's talk about what is the most significant thing, which is we've talked about what science can contribute to meditation. We've talked about what meditation can contribute to science. What can come out of both of these things? What can they come up with together? What can the scientist and the meditator, if they are indeed different people, come up with together? Or what can a single person who is both a deep meditator and a scientist come up with, bringing these two worlds together? Seems to me that it lies in basically two areas. The first is very practical. As our brain imaging technology advances, And as our knowledge of psychophysiology, perceptual psychology, neuroscience, etc., advances, at some point it will be feasible to really look at the physiological concomitants, number one, of high concentration, and number two, of enlightenment itself. Now, of course, in an earlier part of this series, I mentioned that we know some very gross and general things about the physiology of meditators in terms of their alpha wave, their electrical skin conductivity, this kind of stuff. But this is very general. It's not specific at all. Because at this point, we can't really look at a real-time functioning brain. The deep and subtle changes that must take place physiologically when a person goes into high states of concentration and when a person goes beyond concentration to enlightenment, those we cannot yet view objectively, but someday we'll be able to. When we can, we can talk about creating an entirely new model for enlightenment, one completely different from anything that anybody ever came up with, including the Buddha. The Buddha could still only describe brilliantly subjective experience. The Buddha was not in a position to say something like, when the rate of processing of the hypothalamus falls beyond a critical ratio to the rate of processing of the amygdala, then the fixated self dissolves. I'm not saying that that's true, okay? But something that links function, structure, on one hand, to mystical experience, on the other hand, no human being at this point in history has been able to make a statement along those lines. Someday, we will be able to. That will represent a tremendous contribution that science will have made to the meditative path. Because if we have really precise description of the relationship between physiological changes and mystical experience, then we can start to talk about using biofeedback to facilitate the process of meditation. Now, I'm quite aware that biofeedback is a technology that we now have, but I would suggest to you that the biofeedback that we now have is almost useless in terms of enlightenment. It may help people relax and get a little bit more in contact with themselves, and it has good effects for sure. However, the kind of thing that I have in mind would require an exceedingly precise kind of biofeedback where we knew exactly what we were dealing with. We knew the necessary and sufficient physiological correlates of enlightenment itself. And then we could use biofeedback to train those correlates more efficiently. Now, having said that much, please do not think that I am so naive as to think that that in and of itself is going to bring a person to enlightenment. However, I would strongly suspect that it could cut the time required to attempt. There'd be all sorts of other ancillary trainings and learnings and life experiences that would have to go around that. You're not going to just hook somebody up to a machine and just because their physiology emulates enlightenment, think that they're going to get enlightened. But boy, it could sure make my job a lot easier if we could do stuff like this. And that's what I'm looking towards from a practical point of view. Why? Well, this planet is going to hell in a handbasket. We may not last long enough to discover all these neat things. And when the patient is mortally ill, you start considering heroic treatments. What I'm describing is, I realize, pretty radical, They seem pretty radical. But meditation addresses, as I have endeavored to point out, the fundamental problem on this planet, the fundamental cycle. It addresses it directly, and it is able to crack the fundamental cycle, the cycle that underlies all of the specific problems. It is able to crack that. Great. But it's an elitist thing at this point. Only a small number of people participate in the meditation endeavor. Not elitist because meditators don't want to spread it. Meditators do their best to spread it. But it's too hard. It takes too much time. People aren't interested. It doesn't seem relevant. If we had a way of bringing deep experiences more easily, then we could reach a significant portion of the population, and we could start to make a change on this planet. I have an acquaintance who is a brainwave scientist who also speaks Tibetan and is a many decades meditator. And he knows the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama told him in a personal conversation, "You're a scientist, you work with brainwaves. I wish you would create a device that would make it easier for people to meditate, a scientific device of some sort." No less an authority than the Dalai Lama, who, if anyone on this planet speaks for world Buddhists, is thinking along these lines too. This would be one important thing that could come about as a cooperative endeavor. Scientists using advanced tools, not what we've got now, but what we may have someday, to really understand what goes on with the neurophysiology of a person as they go through the different stages on this path. The other area where science and meditation come together is it may turn out that they're both investigating the same reality from different angles. The parallels are rather striking. One can't help think that it's not just a coincidence and it's not just projection. But when we see parallel after parallel after parallel in the deep areas of modern science and in the things that meditators and mystics report, we have to at least take seriously the conjecture that this might not be a coincidence. And that what we might be talking about here is finding a paradigm that is broad enough to include both science and spirituality as a single new discipline that is neither science nor spirituality, but the next human paradigm. Once again, the Dalai Lama has sort of called for something like this, something very much along these lines. Spiritual teachers in general, and meditation teachers specifically, like to use parables or metaphors to describe aspects of the path. And for me personally, my best metaphors, the ones that speak to me most directly, are all derived from science. The issue is, are these just useful metaphors, or is there a little bit more to it than that? Is the fact that there seems to be so much parallelism an indication of an underlying common reality that both the scientist and the meditator are viewing, one from the subjective world of studying consciousness, which is the meditator's world, and the other from the objective world of looking at time, space, matter, and energy. If it is the case that the experts in the subjective world and the experts in the objective world are agreeing because they're seeing the same thing, then this gives us some very important information about the nature of reality. In the sciences, one always works for greater and greater generality. Generality doesn't mean vagueness in science as it does in colloquial English. Generality means universality. So they speak of GUT, G-U-T, the grand unified theory. They even speak of TOE, T-O-E, the theory of everything. Certainly any theory of everything would have to include mystical experience, because that is a major part of human experience around this planet and in all ages. If nothing else, for sure, the sciences provide some wonderful metaphors for situations and experiences that come up in meditation. But as I say, there's so many of them, and the parallelism is so consistent that it may mean something. And certainly, this is something that will be interesting to see as it develops in the future. Let me make it more tangible. What do I mean by things that I find in science that remarkably parallel things that I find in my own meditation? There are four themes that come up over and over again in modern physics. Each one of them is quite counterintuitive. By that I mean that it goes against the ordinary way that any human being would see things. And they're amazingly similar to themes that come up in the mystics. Briefly speaking, the first theme is what is called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Basically, it's a kind of inability to know that paradoxically leads to stable structures existing. The link might not be very obvious. How can the inability to know something be somehow linked to the stability of structures? And the structures I have in mind are the nucleus of the atom and the electron that orbits the atom. Their stability is dependent on something called uncertainty. As I say, why that should be the case is more than I can go into detail now. The second theme is that things that are particles can also be looked upon as waves. Waves and particles are completely different critters, if you think about it. A wave is typically energy that flows through a medium and will join with any other waves and can go around objects and can reflect from objects. But it can also go around objects. A particle is typically a chunk of matter that's separate. It will bounce off another particle. If it hits an object, it can hardly go around that object. And yet, we can speak of even things like bowling balls and planets, very much chunks or particles, as having associated with them a wave function called the de Broglie wave equation. So another theme is that things can be things, and at exactly the same time, they can be doings. They can be waves. So we have a theme of uncertainty leading to stability. We have a theme of somethingness at the same time being a doingness. In other words, a particle can be a wave. We have the theme that space is elastic and rubbery. Space itself has been stretching since the Big Bang, and space can be bent like a piece of rubber. And in fact, mass, gravitational mass, in the Einsteinian concept, is just a wave of space, a twisting, a bending of space. So space is not rigid, space is elastic. And the large-scale deformations of space are called stars and galaxies, and planets, and people. And the small-scale deformations of space are called light waves. The propagation of electromagnetic energy can also be looked upon as the rippling of empty space. You know about water waves, that's the rippling of matter, the molecules of water. But how about ripples in nothingness? It's a challenging concept, but apparently this nothing of space is capable of vibrating in some weird sense. What happens is that when we start to talk about particles being waves, then the somethingness of the particles becomes much less. Things that are something are a little more nothing than what we thought. On the other hand, when we talk about space being elastic and being capable of vibrating, then nothing seems to be a little more something than we thought. The fourth theme is the theme of something coming out of nothing, something being created from nothing. Creatio ex nihilo would be the Latin expression, creation from nothing. This concept was deemed ludicrous by the Greeks and Romans. What do you mean, something coming from nothing? It's a ridiculous concept. It came into Western civilization with Christianity, because Judaism and Christianity believe that God made the world out of absolutely nothing. So creation did take place from nothing. Creation of something from nothing is also the major theme of Buddhism. I've described it over and over again in vivid detail, how zero polarizes and vibrates time, space, self, and world into existence. Before the Big Bang, what was there? Nothing. But that nothing was obviously pregnant with all of the positive and negative needed to create this and any conceivable universe. These themes, uncertainty, in some way associated with stability of all things. Things, in some way not being things, but being doings, waves. Space being elastic. And creation being the automatic consequence of nothing. Nothing can't help but create. According to modern physics, the void cannot help but produce positive and negative energy. It polarizes. These are four major themes in modern physics. Now let's look at the parallels. I've talked about how having equanimity with the need to know leads to a kind of stability in our being. I've described experiencing the world in terms of impermanence, in other words, waveforms, and how that leads to a sense of connectivity. I've also described how it is that expansion and contraction vibrate space into existence. And that when we don't fixate our visual field, the very space that surrounds us presents itself to us as quite rubbery and pliant and bouncy and vibrant. And finally, how it is that nothing cannot help but create something. Inevitably, zero polarizes and vibrates our world into existence. The strange things that the mystics talk about and the strange things that the physicists talk about parallel in a number of cases like this. Am I just finding useful metaphors to compare my meditation experience to what I find in science? Or is there something deeper? I can't help but conjecture that there's something deeper going on here. And I strongly suspect that it is not a mere coincidence that these parallels exist. And furthermore, I strongly suspect that at some time in the future, we'll really understand what this is all about. And out of that understanding will come a whole new mode of human life, so that the path that took us from our Stone Age ancestors into the world of comfort and knowledge, and the path that our Stone Age ancestors had that takes us into the world beyond comfort and beyond knowledge. Those two paths will eventually touch. And who knows what their offspring will be called. When I hear the talks of physicists, it reminds me of things I've heard Sasaki Roshi say. He'd say things like, when you let go of the need to know, then you will be able to see how space is produced from the activity of nothingness. And you'll be able to also see how the activity of the pine tree arises as none other than yourself. So we've talked about many facets, many modes, many functions of impermanence. We've talked about impermanence as a sort of pessimistic worldview. We've talked about impermanence as a characteristic of experience. We've talked about impermanence as something that helps us along in our meditation, as a comforter, a purifier, a guide. We've talked about impermanence as an integrator, as something that allows us to integrate things that have been alienated, something that allows us to experience connectivity. There's one more facet to impermanence. It's the most interesting of them all to the experienced meditator, far and away. However, until one has experienced some of these other aspects of impermanence, this final aspect is extremely enigmatic and strange and basically seems rather irrelevant. So if what I'm about to say strikes you as total nonsense, and worse still, irrelevant nonsense, I hope that you will just listen to the words, have equanimity with your confusion and impatience, understanding that that will purify consciousness. Because sometimes we have to be satisfied with wisdom at the level of remembering words. Sometimes one has to content oneself with just having an intellectual understanding. And then with time, the experiential comes in. At the deepest level, impermanence is none other than the activity of our spiritual source. The peristalsis, the undulatory, vibratory movements of impermanence, are like a formless womb that gestates time, space, and beings, both actual and mythological. The spirit world and the consensual world are all gestated into existence and reabsorbed back into the source like so much foam in the folds of the waves of the ocean, moment by moment. Now, I'm quite aware that that will seem like a total fantasy to 99.99999% of human beings. They have no experience to relate to what I just said. However, there was a time when the great majority of human beings were convinced the earth is flat and convinced that the sun moved around the earth and convinced that eclipses were caused by monsters eating up the sun or the moon, taking bites out of them. We don't look at things that way now. It's a radical shift in paradigm. Even for somebody deeply enlightened, the experience that I just described of oneself and one's surrounding scene being gestated by the activity of impermanence is only experienced occasionally. Occasionally means perhaps hundreds and hundreds of times a day, but not continuously. Even somebody deeply liberated still experiences a lot of the time the world in the ordinary paradigm. What's the difference? Well, the difference is a matter of freedom and a matter of knowledge. The freedom is that somebody that has gone through enough purification can experience the world coming from the source anytime they want. And the knowledge is that even when the usual paradigm arises of seen as solid, self is separate, even when that arises, one knows for sure why it's arising. Right now, I just am not paying close enough attention. And therefore, this usual view of things is arising. Freedom lies in being able to live in both of these worlds and to know when to go to which and to be able to go anytime. A liberated person, when they drive their car on the freeway, goes in and out hundreds and hundreds of times. Self as separate, seen as solid, arises just in time to make the right turn, to beat the horn, to signal, and then it goes back into the direct contact with the peristalsis of the spirit. And then an instant later, it all congeals just in time to do what you need to do, okay, and then back. So that even experiences as seemingly unspiritual as driving your car in summer smog during rush hour on the freeway in LA are absolutely celestial. It's just like sitting on a mountain on a meditation cushion. In fact, there's a great story. Years ago, We used to have in L.A. these places where you could go and do flotation tanks, sensory deprivation tanks. You'd go in there and you float on this high saline solution. So you float like a cork. It's at body temperature. It's all acoustically baffled, so there's no external sounds. And, of course, in that sensorially simplified environment, people get extremely relaxed and also tend to have interesting, weird experiences from that those intermediate realms of power. Because, of course, sensory deprivation is one of the best ways to thrust yourself into those intermediate zones that I talked about. It's a well-known fact. I heard a story from the people who owned one of these places, who were friends of mine, that they had overheard a conversation, two people coming out of the tanks, and the two people happened to be a couple of nuns from the Zen Center of Los Angeles. One, an older nun, very experienced, and one, a neophyte. This is like a true American Zen story, okay? You've heard the Chinese and Japanese Zen stories. I'll give you a true American Zen story. After they got out, the nun who had meditated a couple years said, "Wow, that was pretty great. I mean, that was pretty far out." The more experienced nun said, "Yeah, that really was pretty far out. Felt exactly the way it feels when I drive my car on the freeway." So, impermanence as the source of things, how does that take place? If we conceive of consciousness as a kind of molding process, then clearly one needs two basic doings in order to have any kind of molding. One has to be able to affirm and negate. One has to be able to expand and contract. One has to be able to say yes, but also say no. If you think about it, in our computers, all you need is two. We don't call it a binary system for nothing. All you need to do is be able to say yes and no in the right sequence, and you can store all the data in the universe, theoretically. Ultimately, one comes to realize that the reason that things change is that there are two fundamental forces at work. The force that says increase and a complementary antagonistic force that says decrease. And this is why it's so difficult to understand, because these are abstractions. Abstraction doesn't mean it is abstract, that you can't contact it. It means it is an abstraction in the sense that we look at many, many diverse situations, which all seem to be quite different, and we find that there is an underlying theme that unites them, and we name that theme. That is the process of abstracting. And then once we have named that theme, we're able to see that, oh, this is a reflection of that, and this is also a reflection of that, and this also is a reflection of that, even though they look quite different. When we pay attention to our experience very carefully, we notice that a sensation gets stronger and a sensation then gets weaker. It seems like a completely trivial observation. But as we pay more and more and more and more attention to it, we don't just say, oh, that's trivial, and go on. But rather, we really focus on something that is so obvious as to seem to have no deeper significance. If we're willing to do that, we discover something deep under that superficiality. Actually, this happens in science all the time. Big breakthroughs take place when people pay attention to things that seem so obvious that you would think there's nothing more to say about them. Somebody decides, well, wait, let's look a little deeper here. perfect example of that took place in the 19th century. Actually, in some ways, it's a little parallel to this whole thing I'm bringing up. For countless millennia, human beings had used numbers, but nobody until the end of the 19th century had ever stopped to deeply ponder what we really mean when we say 5 is bigger than 4. You would think there's nothing more you can say about that. What do you mean? Look at a deeper level and tell me something significant about the fact that 5 is bigger than 4. But a mathematician named Georg Cantor said, let's not just take this for granted. Bigger than, smaller than. What does that really mean? What does that really mean? And he spent actually years and years and years pondering the obvious, intellectually pondering the obvious. And as a result of that, he shook the very foundations of mathematics. If you're familiar with what is called new math, that is an attempt to incorporate a little bit of the discoveries of Cantor. Because by questioning the obvious, he eventually discovered something extremely deep about the nature of all known mathematics, and therefore about the nature of science itself. So because Cantor was willing to not just accept the obvious, but look deeply into it over and over again, he came up with this new branch of mathematics, which is called set theory, and is now taken to be the foundation of all known mathematics. In the same way, if we take the seemingly trivial and obvious observation that the sensation in your knee gets a little stronger and gets a little weaker, and we really penetrate over and over and over again observing. So in the case of mathematics, the mathematician penetrated it through intellectual investigation. In the case of meditation, we penetrate it through observational, empirical investigation of our own experience. And what we come to realize is that whenever something gets a little stronger, it is doing so because of the presence of a fundamental, ubiquitous principle in the universe, which we might call the principle of increase, but we could also name by any one of a dozen other names. The word that I personally like to use is expansion. It's one of the words that Sasaki Roshi uses, but he uses a lot of other ones as synonyms for expansion. And when a sensation decreases in intensity, it's because it has encountered the second and complementary ubiquitous principle of nature, which we might call the principle of decrease, but I like to call contraction. Describing impermanence in terms of the two principles of expansion and contraction was not the way the Buddha himself taught. This paradigm, as far as I know, was developed by my present teacher, Josho Sasaki Roshi. Although, when you look carefully at the world mystical tradition, you can see that it is implicit in an awful lot of the previous writers and expositors of meditation, but only implicit, not explicit.